This is Not Your Grandma's Bible Study, making critical biblical scholarship accessible and fun. Hello all, this is Jill with Not Your Grandma's Bible Study, and this is a shameless, selfish plug. I will be speaking on March 15th, 2020, at Divine Life Church in Bethany, Oklahoma, which is a suburb swallowed up by Oklahoma City at this point. I will be speaking at the 10:30 a.m. service on the Samaritan woman found in John, and then at 5:30 p.m. I will be doing a lecture on Empire Studies and the New Testament, some intersections there. So if you're in the area and you want to come to the service or to the lecture, feel free. The address is 3906 North Donald Avenue in Bethany, Oklahoma, and maybe I'll see you there.
Well, hello.
We're back.
We're back.
We're back.
For season two of Not Your Grandma's Bible Study.
I'm not your grandma.
And I'm not your grandma. I'm Jill.
I'm Zach.
And before we get into it, I just want to share with our billions of listeners out there that I finished my PhD. I graduated in December. So I'm Dr. Jill now.
Yay!
Yeah. And I got married a week later. So
the only thing you didn't do is move.
I didn't move. I'm still in my tiny, 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 stinky apartment that smells like my dog.
You only got two out of the most stressful things in life within the same month.
Yeah, not moving. So a couple of changes on this end. So you might notice for reasons that are my own and I do not need to defend, I changed my last name. I'm a feminist, and if you don't want to change yours, you don't have to. I wanted to.
It's your decision.
His last name's way cooler than mine was. So so if you see a name change on our stuff, that's why, because I got hitched.
Yeah.
Got hitched. So anyway, today we're going to talk about the synoptic problem, and we're going to do this over two episodes because it is...
It's a lot of a problem.
It's the Rubik's Cube of New Testament studies.
Yep.
I used to, when I taught that class, that one semester, that one time, forever ago, I told them that this is one of those problems that if I let myself sit with and try to actually solve the problem, like I could see myself like 60 years from now, like haven't showered in a month, 49 cats with like a cork board with like yarn connecting different sources. And I'm just like insane. Very, I don't know. I imagine myself being that lady out of Great Expectations. Just time has stopped in my house. I'm still wearing the clothes I wore the first time I read about it. It is a mind wrinkle. So we're going to talk a little bit about it today and on our next episode as well. So yeah.
Let's get into it by just going over some of the... In this episode, we'll cover the basics, I guess, of the problem. So kind of the 40,000 foot view of what's going on. So talk about the history, talk about the what are called the four heads of evidence. So
five heads.
Five heads, that's right, five heads.
One of them's not that convincing.
Four heads and one kind of smaller head.
One, like, toe.
A part of a head.
Four heads of evidence and...
An arm. Four heads and an arm. And then we'll also talk about what's known as the double and triple tradition material stuff. So if you don't know what any of that is, then you've come to the right place.
We're going
to
tell you.
So history, I'm trying to think of like very beginning, like the fact that so way, way back in the day, a long, long time ago.
In the galaxy.
In ancient...
That's right here.
In ancient times. Folks believed that actually the names of the Gospels did go with the people that wrote them. So we've got some sources for Matthew, and we think we have an idea who Mark might have been and stuff. So people actually believed that, and it was apparent that might know his name of Augustine or Augustine of Hippo, placed them in what we have now as the canonical order. Mm-hmm. And so the first kind of a mention of the synoptic problem is why were they put in that order to begin with? And there are people today, I mean, I remember growing up in church and having people who actually thought that the way in which the texts of the Bible are arranged as a chronological order.
Right, and it certainly is not.
It's
not in the New Testament, and it is certainly not in the Hebrew Bible.
No, Hebrew Bible is not.
The prophets were written before all the, the primeval, if you will.
Yeah.
The forefathers material, so like before Genesis, before the Pentateuch. So.
Well, the problem, I mean, side discourses on that. I mean, yeah. The problem with the Old Testament Hebrew Bible is that so much of it is redacted and finally compiled after exile anyway. So we can look at the way the Hebrew functioned and things like that. So we have some idea of maybe when it was dated. But I mean, so much of all, you know, those, 60 some books, that's so much of it's like, it's all post-exile because we don't have really any idea when it was written anyway. So,
and with New Testament, you know, we knew Paul was writing in the 50s, so that helps with some. And we'll do some episodes later on some of the later letters not written by Paul, and how some of those might be as late as the early second century, even though they're saying they're in the name of Paul or in the tradition of Paul. So we'll get to that eventually, but that's just a little spoiler. But the synoptic problem just knowing that the names of the Gospels got attached to the Gospels later than they were written. So that's important to know.
So it's not until the first, so that's kind of the reigning, so it's called the Augustinian hypothesis, which gets picked up later by somebody else, but that reigns supreme for a really long time until about 1700-something, 1776? Anyway, Griesbach.
Isn't that our... the United States
independence?
When the Constitution was written and we said, no, I'm just kidding.
We said, we support...
We the people support are not in favor of the Augustinian hypothesis. That's in the Constitution. Look it up, people.
Except I think Griesbach was German.
Okay, that's a problem. I stand corrected.
So, Griesbach, one of the things that he did that really kickstarted this whole investigation into the synoptic problem is that he actually put them side by side instead of... So, earlier people had tried to harmonize them and say, you know, so Augustine thought, oh, each one builds on the next, and so then you finally get... Each evangelist was building on another person's work, kind of... chronologically, whereas Griesbach was the first one to say, let's actually put them all side by side and look at what's there.
I think Griesbach was writing in the late 1800s. I think you're 100 years early.
Really?
That's what I have noted here, but you know what?
Published a synopsis in 1776 is what it says.
Maybe it's early 1800s before when he I don't know.
Yeah.
I don't know. We're not going to fact check this.
Sometime.
It's not worth reading Griesbach.
Between 1776 and the early 1800s is when this happened. So Griesbach noticed the special place of Mark in the synopsis. And so he's the first one that puts forward an idea that Mark was the first. And so that's, which gets called the two gospel hypothesis. Who's next? Goes from Griesbach to, well, actually, we have to talk about the gospel.
Oh gosh,
because that comes in the 1800s too.
We'll come up with some sort of document that will help you visualize all of these little parts. So this is why I'm saying this is a problem. This is why you can have a cork board with yarn
everywhere,
and with just a picture of Jesus in the middle.
Yeah.
That's what I imagine.
And to let people know, I don't know what extent we have scholars to lay folks listening, but this is still talked about at SBL. Like, this is not...
Yeah.
We're in 2020, so how many hundreds of years are we beyond? This is still being talked about.
We're going to solve it today. Don't worry.
This is the end. It'll be done
after
today.
Don't worry. You're going to get your definitive answer
It'll be done today.
or maybe the next episode, actually.
So... How would you describe an text, an gospel? I was thinking about this, and I'm like, I don't know how to explain it in simple terms.
A text, quote unquote, behind the text. It doesn't have to be written necessarily. But I think, isn't some of the idea that it would be Aramaic?
Yes, that was the idea.
So there's an Aramaic gospel, whether it's written or oral, is moot behind our gospel texts, right?
Mm-hmm. Okay. Yeah. So yeah,
I blocked the gospel out.
Text behind a text is probably the one sentence summary.
Yeah, text behind a text.
And we say that because, again, like Jill said, we don't have it, nor do we really have any hard or firm evidence that it existed. Just that, I mean, it's kind of like, maybe I came up with this or I heard it from someone else, but it's kind of like a black hole in the sense of, you only know a black hole's there because you can't see the stuff around it. So when you're looking through a telescope or you're looking through stuff, the way they kind of find a black hole is because they're noticing something weird
around it.
And so you're not seeing actually something, but the void of something is actually creating change and doing something. So it's kind of a black hole test in that sense. Maybe black hole is not the best analogy, but there's same effect of you're not seeing the actual thing as it is. You're seeing the effects of that thing on other things.
So maybe the gospels are tip of the iceberg, or gospels what's below the surface.
You can't see it. You can't see it. Mm-hmm.
Except that you can't see it because if it was a written document, it certainly does not exist anymore. And if it was oral tradition, then obviously that's
lost.
Oral tradition is lost to us, except for that which gets written down.
So... next, we move on to, who's next? Weisse?
I don't remember Weisse.
Weisse, Christian Hermann Weisse. So he's talking about what's called the double tradition.
Mm-hmm.
So maybe we can kind of do history and double tradition, triple tradition, kind of all at the same time here. So how would you explain, if I said, what's the double tradition of the synoptic problem?
Yeah.
What would you...
Right. So, well, I think first the big question the synoptic problem is trying to answer is how do we explain the literary similarities and differences between Matthew, Mark, and Luke? John is not a part of this discussion. So they're called the synoptic gospels. That means like through one eye. Mm-hmm. So they're kind of, if you've read them, like you recognize they're very similar. You've probably, I do, conflate stories in them. Mm-hmm. It's really easy. I mean, every Christmas pageant you've seen, you've conflated
That's
Matthew
a good
and Luke's
example. Yep.
Infancy narratives because they're two very different. And if you don't believe me, then go listen to our Matthew 1 and Matthew 2 episodes because we go through that. So how do we explain the literary differences? So it's very text-based question. It's not a theologically based question.
Yep.
It's not interested in how do we explain the similar and different ways that Matthew and Mark and Luke think about Jesus? It's more about their actual language. So triple tradition, as you might guess, is material that's shared by Matthew, Mark, and Luke. So similar stories, even if there are slight variations in wording or syntax between them. So I'm trying to think of a triple tradition example.
I have some. I'll look it up.
The Passion is obviously one. So there are major differences in the Passion narrative in all three, but they all three contain a Passion narrative with similar similarities for redundancy's sake.
So John the Baptist shows up in all three.
Yeah.
The baptism and temptation of Jesus is in all three. Mm-hmm. Jesus is rejected in hometown in all three. The story about the new wine and old wineskins appears in all three. Let's see. The calming of the storm happens in all three. And let's see, there's a whole bunch of them. Transfiguration is in all three. The demoniac boy, rich young man.
There's a lot.
There's a lot. There's quite a few.
There's quite a few. And we'll get to this, but one of the heads of evidence is that over 90% of what's in Mark can be found in Matthew and or Luke. So Mark, there's like one or two small stories in Mark that are not found in the other two Gospels. So triple tradition is things that are found in all three. So how do we make sense of that? Double tradition are stories that are found only in Matthew and in Luke.
Mm-hmm.
So there are lots of stories that occur that are in Matthew and in Luke that are not in Mark. I think one of the big examples is the Lord's Prayer is not in Mark at all. It is in Matthew and it is in Luke. The big blocks of teaching. So the Sermon on the Mount in Matthew is similar enough to the Sermon on the Plain
in Luke.
That scholars argue that they're essentially the same, even if they're not the same. but that's, mm-hmm. you get lots of the same teaching, and that's missing from Mark. So those are a couple of the big things, I think. Mm-hmm. Are there any others that you would want to point out?
Temptation of Jesus really only majorly occurs in the double tradition. Mm-hmm. There, Mark summarizes it, so it does appear in Mark, yeah. but it's not a full. It's not a full story like it is in Matthew and Luke. The woe to the unrepentant cities doesn't appear in Mark, so that's only in Matthew and Luke. There's a bunch of parables that are only in. So a parable of the leaven, the lost sheep, the great banquet, the talents, and the faithful servant are only in Matthew and Luke. They don't appear in Mark.
Okay.
So there, yeah, there's, it's not as obviously big as the triple tradition, right. And that's why it's called the double tradition.
And then, yeah, so you've got triple tradition, all three, double tradition, Matthew, Luke, and then we'll just go ahead and, while we're talking about all this,
yeah,
you have certain aspects of Matthew that are unique to Matthew, certain stories unique to Matthew, yes. and certain stories unique to Luke, and those are considered special material, so special M and special L. Is
sounds like Special K.
Not Special K. Stop it, Zach.
Getting hungry.
It's breakfast time over here. So you've got these two independent traditions that the gospel writers are pulling on their own that seem to be unique to them. Do you have any list for Matthew? I can't think of anything in Matthew. I mean, the infancy narrative is unique to Matthew in its telling.
Mm-hmm.
And then, of course, it's unique to Luke in his telling of it. Luke has I can think of a lot in Luke. Luke has Jesus in the temple. Jesus in the temple as a young boy when he runs from his family.
Right.
Luke has, you know, the Good Samaritan, the lost sheep, the lost coin. Those three parables right there together. Mm-hmm, I think it's mm-hmm. in Luke 15. Those are unique to Luke. So those are materials that are... they're only in Luke. They're not in the other Gospels. And so Matthew has similar material. And as we mentioned, Mark has a couple of stories that are unique to Mark. But there's very little discussion as to why Mark would have unique material, in part because, as we will get to, it is assumed that Mark was written first.
Mm-hmm.
That's a general, I would say, 90% scholarly consensus.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah.
So anyway, those are your three things that you need to... 3/4 things you need to keep in mind. Triple tradition, double tradition, special M, special L. As yeah. we move through, because now that we've got some recognition that there are similarities and there are differences, and it's not just in stories, it is, I mean, there are times where syntax and sentence structure and particular words, Matthew and Luke agree against Mark. They're yep. telling the same story, but Matthew and Luke are using an exact, like, word-for-word, mm-hmm. structure-for-structure sentence within it that Mark is not using.
Yeah.
And that's interesting yeah. to scholars. So are they doing that?
Which is why the problem persists.
Why the problem persists. Although, as with most synoptic problem people who are interested, there's part of me that's like, I don't understand why this problem persists. Because we'll get to that when I talk about...
So, not to jump too much into the second episode, but since we're talking about special L and special M, we should talk about the shift from the two source to the four source, because right. that's basically what we're talking about here. So,
right.
I can't remember it. So, the gospel idea, the text idea, differs from Q.
Yes.
In that Q. So, what's Q?
Q. Okay. So, there's the two document.
Idea.
/4 document hypothesis, however you think about it, is that Mark was written first. Matthew and Luke use Mark as a source material.
Mm-hmm.
How Matthew and Luke use Mark is where the synoptic problem really gets rough.
Yes.
Because most people agree Mark was written first. Did Matthew and Luke work independently with Mark?
Mm-hmm.
Or did they work together? And if they worked independently, how yep. do we make sense of those?
Right.
That double tradition?
Yep.
And it, within that, there's this idea of Q, which is shorthand for Quelle or Quelle. I don't know how
Quelle.
Quelle.
Yeah.
And that's just, it's just German for source. It's not, it sounds cool to native English speakers who don't know German because we're like, oh, it's Q. But I'm sure German folk are like,
cool.
Could we not have come up with something a little bit more creative?
You called it source.
Interesting. The idea is that there was a literal written document. Mm-hmm. So there was Mark and there was Q. And Matthew and Luke used Mark and used Q independently of one another.
Mm-hmm.
And so anytime Matthew and Luke agree on a story, in anything in the double tradition, or they agree in in syntax together against what Mark is saying.
Right.
They change it, but they change it exactly the same.
Right.
Then that's evidence of Q as well.
Right.
The alternative is that Mark wrote first, Matthew. I mean, there are lots of ways.
There's a lot of ways
you
could do it.
But the two biggest ones is the one I just mentioned. And then the second one, Mark's first. Matthew uses Mark. Luke uses Matthew and Mark.
Right.
And at the risk of being considered heretical by the guild, that makes so much more sense to me.
Yeah.
Just because I don't think you need to make up a document when you can explain it without it. Any Q scholars out there? I mean, these are fighting words. These are fighting words, and this is exactly why I'm not going into Q scholarship, because I'm not prepared.
It's so much
for this fight.
That
theory is called Mark without Q, and there are lots of good named scholars who reputable scholars who follow that suit, but they still argue for Mark in priority. So Mark written first. But anyway, that's jumping a little too much into our second. We have digressed.
Yeah, we're kind of moving back and forth between.
Hopefully you're keeping up, but I will come up with some visual documentation to help you keep these ideas straight, some of these key terms and things like that. So that way it's, as you're listening, if you can pull those up, that might be helpful for you.
So let's jump to, we've already kind of talked about, so the special L and special M comes from a guy named Burnett Hillman Streeter. And
Streeter.
So that's
he was such a snarky turd.
He was. Streeter really is responsible for this movement away from a two-source idea for explaining how Matthew and Luke function within the synoptic problem to this idea of a four-document hypothesis. But that's kind of the basic, real basic 40,000-foot overview of kind of how things moved. We start way back with canonical order being chronological with Augustine. We move all the way to potentially having four different documents that are responsible for source material for the Gospels, or for the Synoptic Gospels. John doesn't get to play. But Streeter is important to talk about because he comes up with what are the four or five heads of evidence. And what that basically means is that, as we said at the beginning, that it's very clear that these three documents were not working independently of each other. They are interdependent upon each other. So
they're codependent.
They are literally codependent upon each other. And so we want to talk about those a bit just to show you the ways in which they do connect together. So the first one is what could be called, maybe simplify a little bit, agreement in wording. So there's, as we talked about again, that there's verbal agreement to the point of using the exact same words. New Testament Greek has lots of different terms for things that you can reasonably translate the same way, but whoever wrote these texts are using the same words in the same spot in the story. And so that's definitely something to know about. But
So you mean like arguments from wording, right?
Yeah, argument from wording. So verbal agreement.
Verbal agreement. And in part that is, you know, in the triple tradition, either Matthew or Luke, if not both, agree with Mark in wording. Rarely do Matthew and Luke agree together against Mark. But
right.
when they do, that seems to be evidence of Q, like I mm-hmm. mentioned before.
Yep.
So now there's a guy whose last name is David Dungan. And he thinks Matthew was written first. He thinks Mark was written last. So proponents of what's known as Mark and posteriority, which would be Mark written last, as well as some of those who want to argue for Mark and priority but want mm-hmm. to dispense with Q,
right.
Who don't think that's necessary. And he's sort of a good example of how he combats some of this evidence, showing that they either support Mark in posteriority, Mark written last, or that these heads of evidence are literally just assumptions made, like deductions that you're making after you've assumed Mark is first.
Mm-hmm.
So they're sort of circular, self-confirming prophecy type things. So his argument against this, this argument from wording, he argues against it in two points. So first, he argues that Streeter does not consider at all that there are places, and this is quoting him, where Matthew and Luke depart from the text of Mark together and mm-hmm. return together.
Mm-hmm.
That's a so-called negative agreement.
Mm-hmm.
And then he also argues that Streeter and his predecessors, they atomize the evidence of when Matthew and Luke agree with each other against Mark. And by that, what he means is their Streeter divides these negative agreements, mm-hmm. if you will, into four different groups.
Right.
Streeter, irrelevant arguments, deceptive agreements, influence of cue, and textual corruption. So as you can see, Streeter is very dismissive of these. And Dungan thinks that whenever, as Streeter's atomizing these into smaller categories, that it really dissipates their cumulative effect.
Mm-hmm.
And so Dungan sees this as a methodological error.
Right.
And that if proponents of the two document hypothesis want to successfully defend their position, they really need to revisit mm-hmm. some of Streeter's assumptions and work here, and really take on seriously those negative agreements when Matthew and Mark when Matthew and Luke agree together against Mark.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So I think that's an important, the wording, Streeter's really focused on the positive agreements.
Yes.
Matthew always agrees or mm-hmm. Luke always agrees.
Mm-hmm.
And then he's really dismissive of when Matthew and Luke agree against Mark. And the point of this is, for Dungan and others, is that if Matthew and Luke are agreeing together, perhaps that could be evidence of Q, but it could right. also be evidence that one, Matthew is using Luke, or Luke is using Matthew, so that it's not a definitive
right.
It's not a definitive explanation for the evidence of Q. Mm-hmm. It's not evidence of Q. It's evidence that Matthew and Luke wrote similarly,
right.
And so there are lots of ways to explain it that don't require Q.
Yep, exactly.
So that's Dungan. Okay.
So second one is an agreement or argument from order, in the sense that when you look at the ways in which the stories are arranged in the Gospels, there is some disagreement, but Streeter argued that there's basically an even greater amount of agreement. So, for example, many of Matthew's parables in chapter 13 are found in Luke 8 or in Luke 13. You have groupings that are similar, so you have Sermon on the Mount, and then followed by miracles, and I think that shows up similarly in Luke as well. So there's this idea that not only is the syntax and the verbal agreement there, but there's also this trend in which the material is even arranged similarly mm-hmm. in like Matthew and Luke, and in Mark too, depending on what you're looking at.
And so Streeter's point there is that Matthew and Luke wouldn't have come up with this order independently on their own. So they're following Mark and using Mark, and in the times when they might have material unique to them that's not in Mark,
right.
and they're following the same order, then that's because it was like that in Q.
Yep.
Okay, so Dungan, again, he takes on this argument from Streeter, and he states, quote, I'm going to have a couple of quotes from him because they're pretty good. The inference that this demonstrates the priority of Mark is obviously false. So he's really puzzling at the way that either Matthew or Luke is always supporting Mark. And this is a bit of a long quote, but I think it really helps. He writes, how did it happen that the whole of Mark, almost, is covered precisely by one or the other, or both, Matthew and Luke, acting as if in divinely foreordained harmony and invisible guidance? For, as we all know, neither was aware of what the other was doing. Sarcasm there. Just when Luke goes off into a special passage, there appears at Mark's side faithful Matthew, as if by magic. And just when Matthew suddenly departs on an errand of his own, in the nick of time, back comes Luke, as if in response to a providential bat call. How is it possible? So, Dungan snark aside, and there's a lot of snark in synoptic problem scholarship, a lot of snark. His criticism, I think, should be noted. It's not impossible that this faithfulness to Mark's order was entirely coincidental,
mm-hmm.
But there's another option. So Dungan proposes that Mark, as I said, he's a Mark posterioritist.
Mm-hmm.
so he thinks that Mark abridged Matthew and Luke, and uses an example of ancient author Arrian to demonstrate how a compiler might do this kind of work. So Arrian, when discussing his biography of Alexander the Great, said, wherever Ptolemy, son of Lagus, and Aristobulus, son of Aristobulus, give an identical account of their works on Alexander, son of Philip, I follow this with absolute confidence in its accuracy. Where they disagree, I choose the version which, in my judgment, is the more credible and at the same time the more interesting of the two. In the next episode, we'll talk about some of my issues with the emphasis on historicity undergirding this whole debate.
Sure.
This little snippet from Arian, I think, could help explain how this phenomenon of order comes into play if Mark is written last.
Sure.
It also, if Matthew or Luke is using one or the other in addition to Mark as a source material, it also makes sense of the order.
Yeah.
So again, this argument from order can go both ways.
Yep. Yep.
Okay.
All right. Third one I have here is that there's an argument of what might be called parenthetical material, so the editorial comments.
So style.
Okay. So for example, it's in Matthew 24:15 and in Mark 13:14. So the text reads something like, when you see the desolating sacrilege, or whatever version that you have, there's an editorial comment that says, let the reader understand. And that's exactly the same in both of them. And so, but yes, also just general style elements are found in the double and triple tradition throughout.
And some of that is, one of the arguments that Streeter's making here too, is that Matthew and Luke often, in Streeter's analysis, improve Mark's grammar, because Mark is pretty rough Greek. Improve Mark's grammar and style, and he argues that they're more reverent in their portrayal of Jesus.
Sure.
And Dungan, he doesn't think that this is any evidence of anything. The Tübingen school, I don't know, T-U with the two dots over it, the diacrisis, is that what it's called?
Tübingen
school?
Yeah, probably.
Dungan says that in the Tübingen school, they once considered Mark's rougher Greek, Latin loanwords, the use of historic present in his grammar as evidence that Mark was written in the mid-second century stylistically. Mm. He also has shown that some of these expressions characteristic of Mark, they also appear in Matthew and Luke, but that those of Matthew and Luke occur frequently in Mark. None of the expressions characteristic of Mark appear in Matthew and Luke, but lots that's in Matthew and Luke appear in Mark.
Right.
Yeah. Which seems like a weird argument to make, but okay. For Dungan, this type of omission seems to be out of place under the Mark and Priority model. But E.P. Sanders, and I think that this is really good, he did a big review of early Christian literature and noting specifically, you know, language, style, loanwords, blah, blah, blah. Mm-hmm. And he argues, quote, it might be true that the explanation of Mark's rough Greek, vivid detail, and small size, as compared to Matthew and Luke, is because it is older, mm-hmm. that it is more primitive than they are. But it might be just as true that all of those characteristics are signs of lateness. What he's demonstrating is that these early Christian writers, using other things of evidence, sometimes expand it, sometimes contract it, mm-hmm. sometimes improve grammar, sometimes make things worse.
Right.
I mean, there's lots of, there's not a straightforward path. Mm-hmm. So Dungan's got some arguments.
I apparently don't have the fourth and fifth heads in front of me.
Okay. That's okay. So argument from content is a big one. And like I mentioned, over 90% of Mark is reproduced in Matthew, and more than 50% of it is reproduced in Luke.
Right.
And that's a big one, is how do you make sense of that? Dungan, which Streeter uses as evidence that it is Mark must be written first because so much of Mark is reproduced in the others.
Right.
Dungan disputes this argument from content, noting that it doesn't indicate Mark was written first, but only that Mark is in some sort of literary relationship with Matthew and Luke.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
That it could go either way.
Mm-hmm.
Again, and then the fifth argument head of evidence. This is Streeter's fifth. I'm going to call it the argument from particularity. So he argues that the particularity of Matthew and Luke's arrangement of their sources indicate that they were working independently. What he's saying there is that he thinks that if Matthew had used Luke or Luke had used Matthew, that all three would follow more or less the same arrangement.
Right.
Because when Matthew and when Luke follow Mark, they tend to keep Mark in the order that Mark is in. And then where they the double tradition is what gets moved around and wonky.
Yeah.
So he uses that as evidence that there must be Q, mm-hmm. and that it ends up becoming, people think that Luke followed Q more faithfully because of how Luke follows Mark, but we'll get to that in the next episode. And this evidence that Matthew and Luke were clearly working independently, Dungan argues that Streeter's discussion of how Luke utilizes Mark and Q requires already that one believe Q exists.
Right.
So this last piece of evidence is not actually evidence for Mark and Priority, but rather, according to Dungan, a deduction made from the assumption that Mark is written first.
Mm-hmm.
So he further notes, quote, the fact is the priority of Mark has been traditionally defended directly and, as it were, indirectly, i.e. arguments from Q. I think this is really, really critical to note that this, you know, this logic really becomes really circular. This is how it works. It can be known that Mark was written first because we can see how Luke incorporates Q and Mark. So this logic, it continues to assert itself.
Mm-hmm.
So in defense of Q, there's been this development of the International Q Project.
Right.
And Melanie Johnson DeBoffra, she writes in Jesus Among Her Children, Q, Eschatology, and the Construction of Christian Origins, which is a really good book. Whether you agree with Q or not, mm-hmm. how she breaks down these texts. I think she does a really good job in that weird passage, the children of wisdom will defend their mother, or something like mm-hmm. that. I can't remember what it is, but you asked me to sing and then you were mad and then you wanted me to grieve and mm-hmm. then you were mad about it kind of thing. You're like children in the marketplace. So she writes in that book, in some sense, one could argue that whether or not Q was a text, it is a text. You can buy it at the bookstore and read commentaries and monographs on mm-hmm. it. Q is part of our contemporary popular and scholarly discourse. So now that there is a Q text that can actually be used,
mm-hmm.
That really further perpetuates the argument in favor of Mark and Priority.
Yeah.
And Mark Goodacre, he says that it's easy for Q skeptics to underestimate the sheer persuasive force that the consensus, simply by virtue of being the consensus, continues to exert. So scholars decided somewhere along the way there is Q.
Mm-hmm.
And then scholars a little bit further down were like, well, let's make a critical edition of Q, which is essentially just the double tradition. And then now, well, we have a Q.
Yeah.
So we created the document that we wanted to have.
We thought it existed, so we
made it exist.
We made it
and
exist.
And now you cannot not discuss it.
Q has to be on the
it
table.
It has to be on the table.
Yeah.
For good or for evil, for nothing.
Yeah.
That's it. So, so the next episode we'll talk a little bit more about the solutions
mm-hmm.
to which we've alluded to throughout this episode. And then we will talk about some problems for consideration that I find some unquestioned assumptions in this synoptic debate that I think need to be revealed. Mm-hmm. So, mm-hmm. we're going to have a big reveal here. So,
yes.
Anyway, thanks for listening. Thanks for telling a friend. We would definitely appreciate your 5-star review or at least a 5-star rating. if you don't like us, you don't have to tell us.
Well, here's the thing I'll say about critique or criticism. I feel, I don't want to speak for Jill, but I'll say generally scholars appreciate feedback, even if it's critical, if it's something we can work with. So if you have a problem or we have missed something or there's something you think we can improve on, please send us an email and we can get into contact with you that way. If you leave a really angry review, that's fine, but we can't engage with you and we're not going to take time to take an episode to talk about, so if you want to actually help us improve or you have something that you think we should hear that we can, you know, consider and maybe address, then shoot us an email, or talk to us on one of the socials. I mean, get in touch that way so that we can actually do better.
For sure. If you have suggestions for something you'd want to hear about, let us know. Our email is notyourgrandmapodcast@gmail.com. And I agree 100% with Zach. And also, quite frankly, we don't have that many reviews to read, first of all. But it is not good for my self-esteem to read them. It's not good for, how I think about myself and my scholarship. So
mm-hmm.
I may not even see your criticism to know, what might could be improved here, what might couldn't. And if you just don't like us, then I don't know why you're listening. But Do yourself a favor and let go of toxic things in your life. And if we are a toxic thing in your life,
let us go.
Let us go.
Let us go.
Let go and let God.
You don't need us.
You don't need us. So, all right. Well, we'll catch you next time. Amen and Selah.